It is June 15th, and this is Paige Stewart interviewing Sue Ellerington for the CKUT 30th Anniversary Time Capsule and Zine Project. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Paige.
All right, can you tell me your role at CKUT, or kind of like your getting into CKUT origin story?
Sure. Well, it evolved. I moved out to Montreal after I finished going to UBC out here in British Columbia. And I'd done some work at community radio out here, so it was natural for me to seek that out as something to do when I first got to Montreal. And I went down to CKUT, which was CFRM at that point, and in the basement, the Student Union building. And, I love those environments where people are... It's just buzzing. There was an energy. It just had a feeling of fun about it right from the beginning. And so I started volunteering in the current affairs side of things. And I'd also done some work in various projects, nonprofits, and so on. And so one of the things I offered to do was to pursue grants for summer students, which I did. And we got summer students in there. And then in the fall, the station manager position came open, and by that time I was so ingrained in the place and in our efforts to get on FM that I applied and got the job.
Cool. What were some of your duties as manager?
Oh my God, pretty much everything. We only had a couple of paid staff people and the rest were volunteers, so it meant ultimately the buck stopped at the station manager. We did have a board of directors, but as station manager, you're responsible to them. They don't actually do much of the day-to-day work. So it was pretty much everything from, in my tenure, it was financial was the big one. We were completely behind the eight ball on the financial situation. It hadn't been managed terribly well, and we'd found ourselves in a bit of trouble. So we had to work our way out of that. And then also, I actually had to steward us in through all the pathways of getting on air, and that includes making sure technically we could manage to get there and put together programming that would be good for community radio as opposed to closed circuit CFRM radio. So there was a lot to do. There were long days.
Yeah, I bet. So can you tell me a little bit about what getting CKUT off the ground was like? Specifically after the FM license?
Technically, so we had challenges in almost every domain. So technically it was really interesting because you got the license, and then you had to go through an extensive period of testing your signal and how you were broadcasting to ensure that it didn't interfere with planes and other communications that were important going on around the city. And so to do that, at that time all of the transmitters were sitting up on Mount Royal, and most of the stations had, professional engineering staff who would sort of go through that whole process for them. We didn't. Our engineer was a professional, but he wasn't full-time on staff, and we certainly couldn't afford to have him sitting around full-time. So this process involved having somebody sitting by the transmitter at all times up on the mountain so that when they phoned in and said, turn it off now, turn it on now, turn it off now, turn it on, you could do that. So we ended up with shifts of people just trudging up and down the mountains from the station.
Oh my gosh.
And spending 2 hours or 4 hours or whatever sitting up there waiting for the turn it off, turn it on. And of course, at that time there are a number of stations. Some are boosting their signals, some are changing their orientation, so there's a lot going on. It's not just you and just your station. And so we did that for over the course of, I think it was about a week that we had to do that, and then we got the devastating news a few weeks later that in fact there had been something called spurious radiation that had turned up, and so we weren't going to be able to go on air. And spurious radiation, we learned, is just basically something's interfering with the signal somewhere and they don't know what it is and they can't track it down and they can't fix it. So it could be somebody's, a rusty coat hanger hanging off somebody's chimney kind of thing. it looked like everything was over at that point. But the other stations, who luckily had a lot in stake, had more money than we did, managed to rally and get the CRC C2 agreed to allow us to do the tests again, and this time, for whatever reason, the radiation didn't up, so we got to go on air. So that was, there was that technical side of just getting the transmission done, and then, of course, inside the station, we were building a studio. We were building a 32-track studio, which was a big thing for us at that time. So there was a lot going on, a lot.
Wow, that's awesome. What was your vision for CKUT?
You know, that's actually a really interesting question. When I came to CKUT and became station manager, I became so focused on simply getting us to get on air and resolving our financial difficulties and so on, that I didn't have a lot of time to reflect on what the vision was. But what started to become apparent is after we got the license, everybody had their own vision of what CKUT was going to be. And usually it fell into, we were going to be a representative of what some people would call left-wing issues of the day or progressive issues of the day. And at that time in Canada, there was something called balance of programming, which had become a big deal because it affected campus community stations particularly hard. And what balance of programming was are you providing a balance of programming within your entire program, or do we accept that there's a balance of programming across the radio dial? So it stemmed from a complaint that happened out in BC where organizations representing Jewish people complained because I think it was CITR was airing a program called Voice of Palestine. And they said that's not fair that there be a half an hour or an hour or whatever it was completely dedicated to Palestinian voices and not a corresponding one for Jewish voices. And so the CRTC was trying to figure this out and what they should do about it. But meanwhile, it meant that campus community radio was a little bit on tenterhooks because at stake potentially was your license if you didn't get this right. And so we didn't want to back off and not do handle meaty issues and the things that we thought were important. At the same time, we realized that we had to deal with this issue of balance of programming in an intelligent way. And so basically we rounded everybody up, all of our programming people, key volunteers, and the programming committee, and we went out to a property that McGill owned out in Saint-Hyacinthe and spent about 2 days, I think it was, really going from the very basics of what are we doing here and what does having this privilege of these airwaves mean and what kind of principles do we have to adhere to in using these. And I came out with a statement of principles that I looked at the other day and I think, yeah, 30 years later, I'm still proud of what we did. We talked it through and said, if you are going to have programming that's inclusive of everybody, how do you exclude the alt-right or people who have, you know, for example, these days are trying to promote a white identity or whatever. And it's not as easy on the surface as it looks. And there was a lot of hard work putting into that document and into that process. And it did guide us. It did guide us through some difficult times. And I know at the time the CRTC was really impressed with the work that we had done. And I think that you know, served us well.
That is awesome. That is awesome to hear.
Yeah, it was good. I have to say that 30 years later, in all of the places that I've worked and all of the organizations I've been involved with, that to me was the most thoughtful, considered approach to taking seriously the responsibility we had for the, as I say, incredible privilege that we had.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I suppose now might be a good time to ask you about your coworkers. Can you tell me a little bit about your coworkers?
Oh my goodness! Yeah, they were fantastic. fantastic. I have to say, it's funny because anytime you're in that situation and you get, we had a lot of strong personalities, and you get along strong, a lot of strong personalities together. You have differences of opinion, but it was a really, in the end, it was a really respectful group, I think, and we hashed things out, and it wasn't always easy, but everybody brought such intelligence and I think compassion, knowledge, and the right kind of rebellious spirit to the table, and they were absolutely wonderful. There are, we had 250 volunteers who I consider all co-workers because mm-hmm. every single one of them made it possible for us to do what we were doing. But probably I spent a lot of time most often with the programming committee, and that was, you know, our director of music programming and spoken word programming. The archivist, I spent a lot of time with the bookkeeper mm-hmm. and with finance people. And our sales people, because in the early days, I don't know if there's still sales, but we had to have sales because they accounted for a chunk of revenue that we really needed, and we had a wonderful guy named Joel Savage who would head off into corporate Montreal and sell our wild programming. Mm-hmm. He says he'd go to certain places, big corporations in Montreal, and it would always tickle him to find people, you know, sort of almost surreptitiously listening to Dykes on Mics or something like that. Because at that time, that was very, very, very out there. Mm-hmm. There was nothing else like that being done. And, there were, people like, Chris McGone, who was just brilliant about the music, and Patrick Camus. I mean, they were phenomenal about the music. And both of them had such a wonderful way of working with people and not being pushovers, but just a gentility about them that was absolutely marvelous. Ian Pringle, David Shannon, Don Rossiter, all of these guys were amazing in terms of the sheer amount of time and energy they put into trying to get everything right and the efforts they took around the spoken word and so on. It was they were amazing. France Chevalier, who was just a volunteer extraordinaire, was always there, working in pretty much on whatever needed doing. She would just always help out. The music librarians, yeah, it was a terrific crew of people. It really was.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I haven't heard anything different.
Good. Maybe I should have said it on tape, but I don't know. You must be aware that we lost David Shannon recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he passed away earlier this year.
Oh, my goodness.
And
I didn't realize
that. He was... he was an important part of CKUT. Mm-hmm. He was a voice of reason a lot of times, and yet he never let go of being the activist voice and the voice of change. He was never afraid to challenge. I'm speaking personally. He became a friend over the years. He was never afraid to challenge me and to push me, and in all good ways. He was just true to himself and who he was.
Mm-hmm.
He and Don Rossiter, who also passed away in 2006, mm-hmm. They were the best of friends, and we just loved them. They just brought a spirit and something really, really wonderful to CKT. It just wouldn't have been the same experience without them.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, during Gay Day, when the Gay Day stuff was going on, it was largely Donnie and David who did a lot of the work around that.
Mm-hmm.
David more so than Donnie at that point. I remember sitting in the hallway in the basement there of the sub outside the station, because he kind of became a national spokesperson at that point. You know, he's doing mm-hmm. all the radio interviews from NPR in the States, overseas, and so forth mm-hmm. on this beating of a gay man in Montreal. I remember us having a long conversation because he said to me, you know, I've lost so many friends at this point that I'm not sure I know how to grieve anymore. Because mm-hmm. that was, my concern for him is that in the middle of all this, he was trying to grieve the loss of a friend. And it was I just the humanity that David brought to everything, wicked sense of humor, mm-hmm. Very, very smart. And it, losing him this year has been a huge loss, I think. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if there's any way to encapsulate that within your projects, but he was an important part. To my mind, he was an important part of the time I was there.
Yeah.
And he hosted the Homo Show. He and I hosted the Monday morning radio affair show for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for that.
No problem. No problem.
Can you tell me about your favorite programming escapades?
I have to say, I still reference Gay Day for so many people. In my life today, I work in an environmental organization, and it's a touchstone for me in a lot of ways. So Gay Day came about because a young man named Joe Rose had been beaten to death on a city bus for no other reason than he had pink hair and was gay. And this was unfortunately the kind of thing that happened all the time, but happened, it resulted in his death this time. And we had a meeting at the programming committee to decide what we wanted to do, and we came out of that meeting saying, well, it's really not up to us. We need to turn to the community and see what they think would be an appropriate tribute or statement or whatever they want to do. And so we held a meeting, and I seem to remember there being somewhere around 75 or 100 people came out to that meeting.
Wow.
And very quickly, what we had maybe envisioned as, you know, a half-hour or hour-long tribute to Joe Rose became envisioned as Gay Day. And in that meeting, it was decided to do Gay Day. And this would be a programming for, by, and about the community. And the only rules that applied were the same rules that would apply to any broadcasting. People couldn't libel people, and, you know, we had to adhere to CRTC guidelines and that sort of thing. But beyond that, we didn't exercise any editorial control. It was truly a project of the community. And it was first and foremost, to my mind, it was a wonderful day of programming. It was good, solid radio programming. It took you from, I think we started off in the morning with classical music by gay composers, by gay musicians, and it went all the way through to, I think, a five-hour dance party at the end of the day.
Wow.
That ended about 3 o'clock in the morning or something. And it had a little bit of everything. We had these coming-out stories that were done as vignettes that some of them just moved me to tears with a minute of storytelling. You know, mm-hmm. We had we had Codco wrote a piece for us and did a piece. They were a comedy group out of Newfoundland at the time. We had a story about gay bashing that I think opened a lot of people's eyes at that time, that they didn't realize the stories that weren't making the headlines and how many people were being physically attacked every day just for holding hands with their partner.
Mm-hmm.
It was a truly good day of programming. And for me, the standout moment was this woman. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, mid-afternoon, there was a phone call to the station, and this woman started in, and she started going on about how she was straight and all that, and she must have said she was straight about 15 times. and I thought, I was just waiting for the rant to come, and she, you know, as validation that she was straight at the time, she said, you know, and I have 5 kids, and da da da, and she was going on and on. And she said, and you know, I've always told my 5 kids that they have to be morally right, and you're going on. She said, but you know what? And I said, what? And she said, you know, these are people. And it was like a penny had dropped for her, that this wasn't an issue, that this was about people and their lives. And I thought, oh, there's 5 kids who are going to grow up with something different than they may have grown up with before. And to think that that story may have been multiplied, just, that's why you do it, right? It was just absolutely wonderful. So to this day, I use that story to encourage people that if you just keep making noise, if you just keep saying what's right and doing what's right, then the world does change. It sometimes takes a long time, but it does change.
Wow. That is an amazing story.
Yeah.
So cool.
It truly is. I have a poster up on my wall. It's the thing that I look at when I need to remember that I have to keep going.
Mm-hmm. How did your experience at CKUT inform your future endeavors?
Wow. In a lot of funny ways. I think that, one, it taught me a lot about working with groups of people And I think it made me better in a lot of ways that, unfortunately, people who worked with me at CKUT didn't benefit from. It was upon reflection that I realized that some of the talents of how people work with each other that I observed, and I really learned those lessons, I took away from that. It made me feel strong in the things I believe in. And I think that's important. It's particularly important, you know, in the world in which we're living now. But I've always been a feminist. I've always stood up for myself. And I went from CKUT to working at CJAD. And at that point, the news department at CJAD was run by a guy named Gord Sinclair. And he was extremely misogynistic. And one of the things he used to do was give frilly lacy underwear to his female employees for Christmas. And my first year of working at CJAD was the year of the Montreal Massacre. So the issues around feminism and the way women are treated were very, very uppermost in my mind. And I refused to take the underwear, and, you know, I eventually lost my job over it. But I couldn't imagine not standing up, and I think CKUT had a lot to do with it. I was very inspired by people who lived their life very authentically, and those were the people that CKUT seemed to attract to come and work there, and that gave me a lot of strength to do that. In terms of other things, as I say, I work for an environmental organization now. I'm producing podcasts. I think about how you go out in the world and tell your story, and a lot of how what were very marginalized populations at the time did that at CKG. So I say it was very inspiring and has definitely informed me. And beyond that, the exercise of doing our Statement of Principles and Gay Day both made me realize that there is a truth that underlies all that we do, and if you don't understand that truth for yourself and you don't defend it and fight for it, then you have nothing, and money doesn't matter. We didn't have a lot of money at CKT, but what was there was real, and that is, you know, I'll go to my grave thinking that my life has been well lived if it was a real life, not if it was if I had wealth. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things around CKUT that were really important to me and I've carried with me my whole life. Mm-hmm. And of course it gave me a career. I went on from CJD to work at CBC for many years, and so I can't knock that side of things either. Mm-hmm. Which is maybe what you were looking for in an answer in the first place.
All sorts of answers are good. Speaking of money, what were some of the struggles surrounding money during those
times?
I think
in the early days, there were a combination of things. I think one is that the initial application to get the community, campus community license, had been wildly optimistic in terms of budget, I think. In other words, it put forth a whole lot of things we said we could do. I think it was like many nonprofits, and especially a student-led organization at that time, where there wasn't close attention kept to keeping the books and making sure things were in order. And so in that kind of environment, it just gets messy. And at one point, we had to sit down and add it all up. And when we added it all up, we were short. I think we were short. If I remember correctly, we were short around $200,000 or something of for what we needed to go on air, to get from that point where we were at, what we owed, and then what we needed to go on air. And so we had to do a lot of work with the university, which was, I think, fair to say, it was kind of freaking out about all of this at that point. They were ready to shut us down and say, no, just stop. And so there were a lot of meetings with the university. They made us hire a business manager. And we had to get our books in order. We had to figure out where revenue was coming from. So one of the first things that we had to do was run a referendum to get students to add an extra $2, I think, to their student fees, which was not necessarily an easy referendum because it wasn't like they were trying to save something they'd been used to and they were losing something. We were fighting a referendum for something they hadn't even heard. They didn't really know what it was at that point because we weren't on air yet. Or I think by the time the referendum ran, we were on air very, very short time. Mm-hmm. So that was hard fought, and that took a lot of resources and time and attention to make that that happen. But we did win that referendum. Joel stepped up his sales and went out and hit the bricks and did really well in getting us a lot of sales. And we were able to get to the point where we were on a stable enough footing to reassure the university, which was the most immediate thing to do, so that they wouldn't shut us down, and then to be able to grow from there. So by the time I left, we were on a sound footing, and we had a good path going ahead of us. But okay. they were touch and go times some days. There were some meetings where we came really, really close to being shut down.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
There were a lot of challenges. Mm-hmm. And the university was somewhat exasperated with us anyway. We kept asking for more room, and because we were busting at the seams with the small space we had in the student union building, mm-hmm. and we didn't have an office for the bookkeeper, and they kept saying they couldn't give us more room. So one weekend, we built a loft. And we put the bookkeeper on the top of the loft and stored equipment underneath it.
Oh, gosh.
Just didn't tell the university. And the student union people, eventually they came down and they saw what had gone on, and we had to talk our way out of that one. But they let the loft stay.
Cool.
For a while.
I wonder if it's still there.
Yeah, I know. I'm pretty sure they'd have taken it out as soon as they could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything else? Anything more about your relationship with McGill? And
It was interesting because I didn't go to McGill, so I was an outsider, and I think that was something that was a little odd for McGill. At the same time, I think I was a reasonably stable personality that they felt they could work with. As I say, there were a lot of meetings. There was a lot of where we had to stand up for things, you know, for ourselves. But Gay Day was something that we had to convince them about, because they. You know, this was way out there for them. But, you know, we said we're going to do it, basically. It's just a matter of whether you're on board or not. And then they got behind us, and they did stand behind us on it. The one bugbear used to be security, because on Sundays and days the universities were closed, we had to have everybody go up and sign in at the security office. Before they could come down to the building and be let in, and sometimes the security guys were there, sometimes they were. It was mm-hmm. just, it became that little bit of sand under the skin, you know? just drove everybody nuts. I remember people would have guests for the show, and they'd be late always because they couldn't get through security on Sundays. I just remember that always being a constant headache, having to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But over the time that we were there, I think they came to appreciate how much integrity we brought to what we were doing. I think they came to appreciate when we did our statement of principles and so on that we were thoughtful about this. I think they constantly just shook their head at the things we were doing and rolled their eyes. But in the end, they did let us stay on, and, you know, they didn't try and shut us down. I don't know what happened after I left and how the relationship was after I left, but I think in the end there was a grudging respect on the part of the university for what we actually ended up achieving.
That's good.
Was interesting, too, is when we got the license, it was a very controversial approval from the CRTC, because McGill was this Anglo institution, mm-hmm. and we were the first community license in Montreal, and there was a lot of feeling that it should have gone to a French community radio or French university, mm-hmm. and so we felt very much under the gun to, you know, to prove our worth and to make sure that we were strong, and that it hadn't been a bad decision to give McGill the license. We also, we were under the gun from all sides. I'm wondering, how did I survive that? Because we made the decision to go on air, and we were all set and going towards our on-air date. And the night before we were ready to, the Sunday night before the Monday morning that we were ready to go on air at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, I think it was, it came to my attention that we actually hadn't fulfilled all the requirements that we had to from the CRTC in order to be able to go on air. And this was basically sort of very deep down in the agreement that we had said we would incorporate the organization before we went on air. So technically, we weren't filling all the requirements. And so then we were faced with, well, did we not go on air? And, you know, meanwhile, we put out the press and everything that we were going on air. And so I finally thought, well, I'll go on air at 7 o'clock, and then if we're shut down, we're shut down. But, I don't think we should just not turn up when we said that we were going to be on air. Mm-hmm. And so I phoned the CRTC as soon as their offices were opened and explained the situation, that this had just come to my attention and so on. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was an important thing because you have to have a legal entity that's responsible for what's being broadcast. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't kind of the end of the world. So I said to them, well, you know, what does this mean? And they said, well, we know you're on air. And I said, so we've got approval to be on air. And they said, well, we didn't say that. So it was essentially wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We know you're on air. You get this dealt with really quickly, as fast as you can. But basically, if you get yourself into any trouble, i.e. maybe over balance of programming issues or anything, mm-hmm. then we will not stand behind you at all. As far as we're concerned, we'll yank you off the air immediately.
Wow.
Because you haven't fulfilled the requirements. So next call was to a lawyer to get the incorporation going. But it did mean that in our early days, we had to tread a line of trying to do the kind of programming we thought was important, we knew was edgy, but that wasn't going to get us pulled off air. And
yeah.
That sort of forced a certain discipline on us right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. How did you... Oh, geez, the question fell out of my head.
God, that happens to other people.
How did you balance wanting to be on the cutting edge and also wanting to not get kicked off the air? What were discussions surrounding like that like?
Well, I think that the fact that we had done our statement of principles that would put such thought into it was somewhat persuasive at that point as well.
Mm-hmm.
It gave us a clear sense. We really hashed out the issues around it. So, first of all, whenever there was a potential issue coming up, it would go to programming committee and we would talk about it within the framework of the statement of principles. There wasn't always agreement. There was sometimes compromise, sometimes just decisions that had to be made that people weren't necessarily particularly happy with. I can't think of one at the moment, but, you know, they were ongoing. The second thing was that we really said to everybody who was on air, you have to know why you're saying what you say.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, at the time, there was a song out by DOA called Fuck You. So we said, okay, that's swearing on air. We're not going to say you can't do it. And I will defend to the ends of the earth, you know, if you can give me an articulate explanation of what that song's about, how it fits in the context of the day, why it's an important song to play, all of those sorts of things, influences around the song, then I'll defend you to the ends of the earth. But if you just are kind of going, oh, I wanted to play Fuck You, which was a big deal at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to put the word fuck on air. Then you lost your spot right then, right there.
Yeah.
You weren't going to be on. It was the only way to be fair to everybody else who was putting so much work into making this thing a success.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you stand behind what's right, but there were too many people fighting on too many levels to try and do programming that was interesting and stimulating and that really made people think to throw it all away because some idiot just wanted to say fuck on air.
Yeah.
You know? So you have to be, you can be rebellious, you can have the revolution, but you have to think about what you're trying to achieve. And that's, so we were fairly dictatorial about it, I'm afraid, in the beginning because we were on such thin ice
mm-hmm.
with the CRTC.
Right.
And it was a contentious license in Montreal, so it wouldn't have been difficult for somebody to complain about us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. That's a really good way to put it. That's a really good policy.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, as I say, I look back and think, I think we aimed high at that time. And I think we got to a lot of the spots that we aimed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Couple more questions.
Sure.
What is your wildest memory of CKUT, or what's a scandal that you remember?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm going to get into the vandals because even 30 years isn't long enough on some of them. I'm going to say that I think the wildest time has to be our first anniversary party. Mm-hmm. So we had the Rialto. I don't know if the Rialto is still up and running in Montreal.
Yep.
It was a theater up on Park.
Yeah, I live right by it.
Old theater, yeah. And so we decided to have our first anniversary party at the Rialto. And one of our advertisers at the time was Molson's. So they ended up supplying us with a lot of cheap beer.
Mm-hmm.
And it just became kind of, it was a bit of a free-for-all in terms of organization. So basically, if somebody had an idea, they made it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended up in a party that, you know, there were popcorn machines. Somebody brought by a ton of ice cream at midnight from a local business. There were I remember James Bond trailers playing on the screen for some reason, and people dancing on speakers in front of them. And it was there was a lot of beer flowing. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was sometime around the middle, you know, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning or something. There was actually an earthquake. And this huge chandelier started shaking like mad and fell down and luckily didn't hurt anybody, but it was one of those kind of really crazy nights that...
Oh my gosh.
And it was funny because we'd given away tickets on air, so it meant people, you know, lined up around the block early to get some extra tickets and stuff like that. It was just had a whole air of a little bit wild to it, you know. Fun. A little bit on the wild side. We had a great after party from Gay Day down in the village.
Mm-hmm.
At Block. I remember a lot of dancing on tables at that one too. That was a lot of fun.
People have been shying away from that question.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
30 years on the party should do it, I think. Oh, yeah. And there was the National, the CBC news program, The National,
mm-hmm.
had somebody there filming because they were doing a story on Generation X.
Oh, my gosh.
It was just this really, like, everywhere you turned, something odd was happening, right? It was like one of those nights of station manager where people were coming up to me with just strange questions, like, oh, the popcorn machine's running out, or, you know.
Wow.
The news crew wants to talk to you or whatever. It was hilarious. It was hilarious.
That is amazing.
Tomorrow I have a picture of a few of us going home at about 3 o'clock in the morning and back of our truck that we had all of the equipment in. And I think we all look a little bit dazed by it all.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, I've got to find that documentary on Gen Xers.
Yeah. It was done by Josh Fried.
Okay.
Was it Josh Fried?
Oh, actually, that's all of the questions that I have.
Oh, okay. It's been fun.
Yeah, so thank you very much. Do you want to say anything in closing, or?
No, I'm just so happy that CKUT is there and thriving 30 years later. It makes me feel like that what we did, you know, mattered.
Yeah.
And and I'm so happy to see it there and thriving and doing everything it does. I think it's important, and it's really important these days.
Definitely.
Really, really important these days because so many bigger and better funded media outlets and places that can amplify the voices of the people are just folding like paper accordions in terms of what's happening in the States. And to have independent voices and to use them to shout as loudly as possible is so important.